Today is Wednesday, September 6th. We're going to be working on epithelial tissues and then save some time for review. Okay, so let's re-hit osmosis, page 37. Let me raise the screen and we'll just look at some scenarios. Okay, something to appreciate as we think about osmosis is that not everything can cross a plasma membrane. We describe plasma membranes as semi-permeable or selectively permeable. So if you think back to plasma membrane construction, we know that plasma membranes are made up of two layers of phospholipids. What's it about the phospholipid that makes it picky or selective?
The tail is hydrophilic.
You got it. Good. Okay. Okay, you got it. So there's the issue. We've got water-loving heads and we've got water-hating tails or water-fearing tails. And since you've got two layers in your plasma membrane made up of these phospholipids, it's those tails that are picky. It is the tails that are selective. And so I've got, you know, you have to play mental games with yourself to get this to stick right. So I always think about if somebody fusses at a dog, they get their feelings hurt and they tuck their tail between their legs and they go and they hide and they pout. So the tails here are the picky portions. They're the ones that are sensitive to water passing through. So that's just the mental game I play to keep it straight, as to which portion of your phospholipid bilayer is picky or selective. So it's this portion in here that makes our membrane selectively permeable. And if you're a water-based item, you're not getting through. Because those tails say, hey, you know what, we don't like water, so if you're water-based, you can forget coming through our bilayer. So that's how they can prevent certain items from entering. Other things that are small or lipid-based have no trouble wiggling through the phospholipid bilayer. So, you know, gases like oxygen and carbon dioxide, fats and oils can move through that phospholipid bilayer, and they do so because they're small and they're made of a fat. Notice what they're not made of.
Water.
Yes. So water is not allowed to come through that phospholipid bilayer. Okay. So keeping that in mind, when we think about osmosis, the deal with osmosis is the fact that sometimes ions or solutes or whatever could be located on one side of the membrane and they can't move to the other side. If they're water-based or if they're big, they may be trapped on one side of the membrane and not the other. So let's just extend this on out like it was a plasma membrane. And I'm going to use an X for my solute, and I'm going to say this solute cannot travel across the plasma membrane. I'm going to put a bunch of my solutes inside my cell. And I'm going to put just a few of these solutes on the outside of my cell. If my plasma membrane allowed the solute to move, how would it move? If my plasma membrane allowed the solute to move, how would it move?
From high to low.
Yeah, there's your high concentration, there's your low concentration, right? Okay. But we're saying that this particular solute's not allowed to be moved or transported. It's basically stuck, where we have a lot of the solute inside your cell and actually very few of your solutes outside your cell. So we have another way to distribute the concentration, you might say, equally. And so instead of allowing solutes to move, we actually allow water to move across the membrane. And water moves, that's right, by osmosis, and it always moves to the area where I have the most solutes. So in this picture, where is water going to move from and to?
From the outside to the inside.
To To the inside, good. So it comes from the outside, it comes to the inside, okay? And so why is water moving to this area of higher solute concentration? All the salt, exactly. So the salt or solute or particles, whatever they are, wherever they're most highly concentrated, we want to dilute them down. We want to make them less concentrated. And since we can't move them, the only thing we can do is dilute them with water. So I always think about if I've made sweet tea, I don't measure sugar when I make sweet tea. I don't know if you do. I just dump in what I think looks like the right amount, you know. And then you taste, you're like, yeah, good, I'm good this time. But next time you're like, well, that's too sweet. Add some water. That's what you do. So if you've got too many solutes, add some water, okay? And that will dilute down the concentration and make it more equal to what's outside the cell. Okay, so here's the catch. We say that your cell in this situation has been placed in a solution with a very low, there's my keyword, low concentration. Would you say this solution out here is hypotonic or hypertonic?
Hyper.
Low is
hypo.
That means your cell will bloat. Exactly. So there's our water. It's going to come across these water channels. Water comes in here. Okay. So why might your cell bloat? Right, and so what we're trying to do is make this concentration of solutes equal to that concentration of solutes. And you're right, the water is going to come in until we equalize solute or salt concentration. And you're right, that may eventually result in the rupture of the cell. And we have a fancy name for that. It's called lysis. Yeah, so that's right. We may bloat or rupture or lysis this cell. Video with hippo the hypo, you know, or hypo the hippo, whichever way. Okay, so the catch is hypotonic solutions are great for rehydrating your body. If you're dehydrated, that's all we do. We drink hypotonic fluids, whether it's milk, a soft drink, sweet tea, even Gatorade, they're all hypotonic to some extent, less concentrated than our cells. So, you know, this kind of sounds scary because you're putting something in your body that can make your cells bloat and potentially rupture. You actually listen to your body, most of us do. You know, we stop drinking when we feel full and bloated, and that full bloated feeling comes when we've had enough fluids to drink. So we stop drinking because we know that we're getting close to making our cells, you know, get too plump, and they would eventually lysis if they got, you know, a step further. So it's called a thirst mechanism, and we do listen to that, and we shut off our drinking when we get close to that point. So that reduces the risk of us getting, you know, into a really bad, scary situation with bloated or ruptured cells.
So in the same conversation, will you explain this in a different way, I guess, explain the whole analogy about drinking salt water from the ocean then?
Sure. Why don't we do a picture for that, and we'll explain that one. Okay. Okay, so your cell's concentration is about 1% salt. That's not really salty. the ocean's concentration, if I remember correctly, something like 3% salt, which to us tastes really, you know, briny, salty. So the situation this time is I've tried to make it obvious that there's more solutes outside the cell. This is the case where you may have drunk salt water, and we have actually less solutes inside the cell. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it tastes nasty for starters, yeah. Which hopefully is a deterrent for most people who don't realize what it's going to do to you. Okay, so these solutes actually cannot come into our cell. They cannot move from high concentration to low concentration, which is probably good because it would become pickled in salt. So that's probably a good thing that we can't do that. So the other issue is we have to appreciate that we have a, here's my key word, higher concentration of solutes outside our cell. So we will name this solution a hypertonic solution. Say that again.
I think I understand already.
Okay. Go ahead and finish it.
Yeah. Because then it's going to pull out, instead of hydrating yourself, it's going to, the water's chasing the salt, so it's actually going to go towards the higher concentration.
You got it. You got it. That's right. Okay, so one more time. Why does water leave the cell?
It always falls salt.
And the salt, the more salt is located where?
Outside.
Yes, so this high salt concentration out here, that's going to suck the water out of your cell. To kind of give you the full picture, because you're going to 211, you know, when you get all this fluid in your bloodstream, your kidneys say, oh, hey, extra fluid, pee it out, right? So there goes the fluid, it's flushed out in your urine, and after you pee out all this fluid, oops, it's too late. And so you're really, really thirsty once you start flushing yourself using salt water. So that's the end result of having drunk salt water. So when does water stop this mass exodus from your cell? Equilibrium, right. So the movement in versus the movement out is going to come to a halt when you reach equilibrium. That's the key thing, okay? So this time we're going toward a higher solute concentration. What happens to cells in this situation?
Crenation.
Shrivel, crenation is the word, you're right.
Nice to hopefully enjoy that last drink.
because you'll be hallucinating if you drink it any more after that. Okay. This help a little bit with osmosis?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah.
The one we just talked about earlier, that kind of worked with the negative feedback loop. Talk about the water, when we drink it, and we stop. We get full of water, and we stop drinking.
It's exactly a negative feedback loop. Yeah, that's a great example because, you know, most of us listen, but those people that do those contests don't listen to their brain and their body that says stop drinking, but yeah, it's very much a negative feedback. Yeah. All right, and y'all good with isotonic?
Yep.
Okay.
There's no net movement with isotonic, right?
Yeah, no net movement, that's right. Yeah, while we're looking at this stuff, let me go ahead and take you to page 41. New material. We didn't cover this in class on Wednesday of last week. That's been a long time since we've talked about this stuff. So facilitated diffusion at the top of your page is one last type of passive transport. And passive means what?
No energy.
No energy. Good. So no ATP is required for the movement in facilitated diffusion. So I'm just going to leave the drawing of a plasma membrane up here so we can take a look at it. Sometimes, you know, if you've got a really big molecule to move, then you have trouble getting it across the plasma membrane. Glucose, you know, even though it's an incredibly small molecule, is too big to go through the phospholipid bilayer without assistance. So, you know, if you've got something that's fairly large, you don't necessarily want that to rip holes in your membrane. So it's still going to move with its concentration gradient, but this time we let it travel through a bigger plasma membrane protein channel. So I think of a protein channel as a doorway. It can stand open and it lets certain types of molecules through. So if I've got a lot of glucose sitting outside my cell, and just a few on the inside of the cell, we still have the concentration gradient. We're still going to move from high to low concentration. The only catch is we're trying to move a really big particle from high concentration outside into the cell where there's lower concentration. So the catch is, and this was probably the last minute or two of class on Wednesday, the reason we have to move from high to low concentration using a protein channel is, one, we have a larger item to move. And what's the second reason? What do we have to use?
Protein channel.
Protein channel, yep. So we have to use a protein channel. If you're coming into the cell with the concentration gradient, there's no ATP that's necessary. But you're right, if you're going against the concentration gradient, then you've got another problem. And you're right, ATP does have to be used then. So comparing this back to simple diffusion, does simple diffusion require a protein channel?
No.
No protein channel is necessary. In fact, with simple diffusion, all we have to do is move items from high to low concentration, but they are either small or they're made of what?
No. Lipids.
Lipids, yeah. Small or made of lipids, right, because anything water-based is going to be expelled or excluded by that plasma membrane layer, okay? So let's turn the tables. Let's go down below in your worksheet and talk about solute pumping and active transport methods. So I want you to take a look at my molecule here. We have more molecules inside the cell, less molecules outside the cell. And I want to move those molecules from low concentration outside the cell to high concentration inside the cell. Okay, so first thing you identify is I'm not going with the flow, right?
Right. I'm going against it.
Yeah, I'm going against it. So I'm going from low concentration to high concentration. Anytime you're doing this, you have to employ an active method to move your molecules, and the method we're going to use here is called solute pumping. So it's a way for us to move things against their gradient. Anytime you do this, what do you have to use to pay off that pump?
ATP.
Pay it with ATP. Every time the pump moves a solute across the membrane, you pay the pump with an ATP molecule. So it'd be like this. It'd be like every time you rode the elevator, you'd have to put in a quarter for the ride. Okay? So if the door's open, you get on. Oh, sorry, you have to pay a quarter too. So everybody that gets a ride is going to have to pay with an ATP molecule. So that does require the cell some energy to pump these items against the gradient. This process works for stuff that's moving from low to high concentration, and sometimes you may have bigger stuff that needs to be transported this way, but primarily it's when you're going against the concentration gradient from low concentration to high concentration. The way your muscles work and the way your nerves work depends on protein pumps called the sodium-potassium pump. So that is certainly something we'll come back and revisit later on in this course. Okay. Do you have any questions on this active transport method here called solute pumping? So far, so good today? Okay. The last thing we've got down there is endo and exocytosis. And I think I'll show you a picture of that. So, you know, sometimes a protein pump or some kind of channel is not going to cut it, and you have to use another method to bypass the membrane structures altogether. And that's when we use endo and exocytosis. Just keep straight the prefixes there. What does endo tell that we're doing? Moving it in, right? And exo is moving it out, okay? Export, right? And phago and pinocytosis are just types of endocytosis. A lot of times people get hung up on phago means to eat and pino means to drink, but really it's bigger items and smaller items. That's what those two terms differentiate for us. Phagocytosis is bigger items and pinocytosis is smaller items. I'd like to think this looks like a ghost eating something, maybe an egg. But instead of using a proton or a protein pump or anything of that sort, what we end up doing, which you can't see in this animation, is taking the cell membrane, wrapping it around what you want to incorporate, letting it join with your membrane, and then just kind of squeezing it into the interior in a sac form. And so that's what we see happening here is we create a sac, we wrap up something, we bring it in, and there you go. You've now got that inside the cell. This is how we get rid of bacteria, by the way. You take bacteria, you surround it with little pinched arms from your cells. They grab around the bacteria, they pull it in, they put it in a sac like you can see here. They treat, your cells treat it with some chemicals to kill the bacteria, and then you spit out the other side, just the dead parts.
Basically, they just give them the boot.
Give them the boot, basically, yeah. And these are not sausage links or hot dogs. These are anthrax, which you probably have heard of, right? Yep, so that's in fact a white blood cell. Look, it's trying as hard as it can. I'm gonna eat you. It says I'm gonna stretch, I'm gonna get you. So it's doing all it can to take in that anthrax bacterium. But that's endocytosis. So it will destroy the bacterium and it will spit out, or you could almost say it's pooping out the parts. So, yeah. Hey, what better way to kill your enemy than just eat it? That's what your white cells do. So endocytosis is, you know, phago in terms of taking in big items, pino here taking in smaller items, and then of course exocytosis pushes out or exports those packages to the outside of the cell. To tie this back in with organelles, do you remember the name of the organelle that packages and modifies vesicles? Golgi. Yeah. So Golgi is the one that plays a role for endo and exocytosis. Good. All right, so that should do it. That takes you down to the bottom of page 41. So why don't we cover a little bit of histology, and that way we'll kind of be on track with our content, and then we'll do a little bit of review afterwards. So this tissue stuff is not on the test on Monday. This tissue stuff will be on test number 2, yay. So what I recommend is if you made tissues like flashcards for lab, we're not gonna test you on the pictures here in lecture. I know that's a relief to hear, but what you do wanna keep those flashcards for is for function and location. So it's worthwhile just to not toss those once you finish your lab test today to hang on to them for this upcoming test number 2 in lecture. I know you guys are aware of what histology is from lab. It is a study of tissues, and there's 4 major categories. We call them the general categories of tissue. They are epithelial, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. So we're going to explore a little bit about epithelial tissues today. We know that these are the tissues that cover and line body surfaces. And because their job is to cover and line body surfaces, they'll have an apical surface and a basement membrane. So I'd like to show you what these two parts are so you can identify them on any typical epithelial tissue. So in this picture, you have epithelial tissue at the top. You know, epithelial tissue does have a free surface known as the apical surface. That is a surface not attached to anything else. So up here at the very top, you'll notice there's no other tissue attached to it, so that must be the free surface. How do you find the basement membrane? Yeah, it's usually connected to connective tissue, right? And the transition is pretty abrupt. It's usually pretty easy to say, hey, you know, everything below that point where you find the basement membrane looks like a totally different tissue type. And most of the time you're going to be right if you can identify a different tissue type under that basement membrane. I do want to caution you, sometimes pictures are upside down, so you can't always get hung up on the fact that apical is up. Some pictures show the apical surface near the bottom of that slide picture. But that is something we find uniquely in epithelial tissues. We don't find apical surfaces or basement membranes in connective, not in muscle, not in nervous. Epithelial tissues are avascular, meaning what?
They have nerves.
No blood vessels, right. So this picture looks like really thick epithelial tissue. Everything that's pink in this picture from this bottom portion up is all epithelial tissue. In reality, that's about the thickness of a piece of paper towel. So, you know, you're talking about probably 50 to 100 layers of cells in this picture. All of those cells get their nutrients, their oxygen, get rid of their waste products by simple what?
Diffusion.
Yeah. So, you know, that's why these topmost layers look packed and dead, because they are. You know, they're too far from a source of oxygen and nutrients to stay alive. So eventually we slough off and get rid of those topmost layers of cells.
And did you say it takes like skin, like a certain amount of days where we generate a new layer?
It's about 2 to 3 weeks, and then we'll have a completely new set of skin cells come up and the old are gone. So it depends. Certain tissues grow faster than others, but all epithelials will constantly replace themselves. Yep. So even though epithelial tissues lack a blood supply, they do have nerves, and we call these nerve supplies innervations. That's how you can feel the world around you. You can even feel vibrations. You can feel temperature, light touch, pain, all that through your skin and through your internal epithelial tissues. You're probably familiar with this naming scheme from lab. We give our epithelial tissues two names when we're talking about them specifically. We first put whether they are simple or stratified. What does it mean to have a simple tissue?
One layer,
good. And stratified is at least
two or more,
good, okay. And so when we look for the cell shape, squamous or cuboidal or columnar, we are looking for the majority of the cells to fall into that category. So even though you may not be able to see the actual cell shape, you may see the cell's nucleus. So let's talk about that for just a moment. If I've got a squamous cell, how should the nucleus be shaped? Kind of flat, yes. So kind of like an egg or a football laying on its side. If we're talking about a cuboidal cell, how is the nucleus shaped? Yes, square cell. Pretty circular nucleus. And a column-shaped cell?
Elongated,
good. So that's a definite clue to look for if you can't really see that cell shape. All right, so we know to put simple or stratified first in our naming scheme, and then the cell shape comes second in our naming scheme. Just to go back and look at this picture for just a moment, when we're talking about the cell shape, we look toward the apical surface. That's where your oldest cells are located. The newest cells are located where?
The bottom,
the basement, yeah. So in this picture, look toward the apical surface. That's the oldest, most true cell shape. The newest cells down at the basement membrane will lie to you, and they tell you there's something that they're not. So if you use this picture, the bottom cells look like they're cuboid or even columnar, don't they? And they'll mess with you. And of course, the ones near the top, they're near the apical surface, they do look more flat. Yeah. Just kind of as a side note here, down at the very bottom, you've got three types of cell junctions. Did you get your blanks on there? Right above that, did you get your three blanks? Okay. Epithelial tissues have these things called cell junctions. Other cell types have them as well. Other tissue types have them as well. But I just wanted to introduce them here so we could appreciate how these tissues hang together. Some types of epithelial tissues are held together with what's called a tight junction. We think of these tight junctions as spot welds, okay? So they're kind of like anchors that keep one cell linked to the neighboring cell, and they prevent fluids from passing between the two cells. If you think about the tight junctions in your skin, what does this prevent you from doing in any body of water? Imagine if you got in the salty ocean, what would happen to all your fluids? They would be sucked out right by that hypertonic ocean water. So you really would. You'd get out and weigh like 20 pounds lighter, right? So yeah, tight junctions prevent fluid movements between cells. They not only prevent you from gaining water, they prevent you from losing water. So they're good to have. The second type there is called a gap junction, and they're exactly as their name implies. They are gaps between neighboring cells. They are open protein channels. And they let ions or fluids move freely between the neighboring cells. So these are like the best of friends. These cells can exchange whatever they need to. So if you think about hotel rooms for just a moment, you know, sometimes hotel rooms have the adjoining door between them. That's a gap junction. Okay, you don't have to go in the hallway to knock on the neighbor's door. You can open the door between you, and that's allowing for the free flow of ions or whatever solutions between those two cells. The third type of cell junction is called a desmosome, and that prefix desmo means something, band. Okay, desmosomes are bands, and that actually helps to keep cells banded together. When you were a kid, did you ever do a three-legged race?
Yeah.
That person fell, you fell, right? That person ran, you ran. So if you've got desmosomes linking together cells, if that cell moves, you move, right? The whole goal here is to make sure that your cells stay banded together and that they are able to accommodate for the stretch and movement that we happen to see in our epithelial tissues. Just think about your skin, you know, your elbow, for instance, there's a lot of stretch that's in that area. If you didn't have desmosomes banding together all your skin, it would tear instead of giving way. So this helps to keep those layers banded together. If you've ever been really dry or perhaps sunburned and you lose skin in layers or sheets, you can thank your desmosomes for those sheet-like effects that your skin will be lost in. So that's really kind of the underlying issue here, is keep those layers banded together. Okay. Let me take you on a tour of epithelial tissues. They're found on page 44. You guys are pro at this, right?
Yeah. Not yet.
Not yet. Okay, so our first specific type of epithelial tissue is called simple squamous epithelial tissue. And the word simple tells us how many layers?
One.
Just one layer. Good. What's that?
I said that's a weird picture.
Yeah, that looks so much different than the other simple squamous.
That's what I'm
saying. Yeah. I don't like this one because it just doesn't look like anything.
It looks like a giant jigsaw puzzle.
It does. And the point I was going to make about this picture is it's very low magnification. It doesn't give you a sense for simple squamous. It doesn't even give you a sense for really what you're looking at all. What we want to do is zoom in on it and actually get a better feel for it. So we know that one of the locations for simple squamous is the lung air sacs, known as the alveolar air sacs. And when you zoom in, you can get a better sense for those flattened layers of cells. I don't know. I don't even know if I trust these as looking squamous-like. You know, if somebody told me that simple squamous, it's like, okay, I'll buy that. I'll have to believe it. But it does. And the only thing that confirms that it's epithelial is what? Apical surface and a basement membrane. And guess what? You can only see the apical surface. The basement membrane is like behind here, so you can't really see that depth. But yeah, that's what makes me say, okay, this has to be epithelial. It does have a free surface. Okay. So it's not the best of pictures. It doesn't really live up to its advertised name of squamous, but I think it more or less looks like a simple tissue. Would you agree there?
How do you see an apical surface? I'm so serious
because
I don't see that.
Okay, so...
I just see the white.
What if we were flying over the top of this and we were looking at the top surface? The basement membrane would be behind. Yes.
So that's like
looking down on it.
Looking down on it, yeah. And this is another view of simple squamous, which, depending on your perspective, how you shift it, makes you think it's something else. So, you know, if you do, I know you guys are taking your lab test today, but if you do internet searches, just beware. They have all sorts of stuff out there that can mess with your brain. Pick next week. Okay, then that's good. Next Wednesday. Oh, good, okay.
You're explaining this much better.
They'll get better with time. So let's talk about locations of simple squamous. This is a very thin layer of tissue. It's great for places that we need diffusion to occur. So lung ear sacs is one good place for that. What's another example?
Kidneys,
good. Where else? Capillaries, good. And one more? Serous membranes, good. So because it is very thin, it's great for diffusion. Items can move very easily when you have one single layer of tissue. Let's see, stratified squamous is next. It's going to have multiple layers of flattened cells. So under the cell layers there, it's at least two or more. Okay, for cell layer, it's at least two or more. That's a great example, sure as skin. Yeah, because if you had one single layer, boy, you couldn't touch anything. You sure would. And your clothes would rub them off. This is a great picture for driving home the point that your apical surface is the one with the truest cell shape. In this picture, the free edge up here on the top has the flattened cells. You know, everything up to that point looks columnar, looks cuboidal. It'll mess with you if you look down there. So we have to trust that apical surface. What I do is I look at the apical surface. I find my basement membrane where we shift to a different cell shape. And we say, do I see one layer between those or do I see two or more? And I think in this picture we can safely say I see at least two or more layers between my apical surface and my basement down here. And so I say, okay, this is a stratified tissue. Okay, so it's not perfect. It's, you know, guesswork a little bit because some of these tissue slices are not done exactly right. So they pick up what looks to be multiple layers in the background. But this does look like a great stratified squamous. Right, because they're so tiny and so hard to work with. So you already told me skin is a great example of stratified squamous. Where else can you find this one? Lining of your esophagus. Lining of your mouth. What comes in must go out. Yeah, vaginal canal, anal canal. So places that get abrasion are going to experience stratified squamous. And inside your body, we're going to have what's called non-keratinized stratified squamous. Okay. On the outside of your body, you're going to have what's called keratinized stratified squamous. What's the difference, you know, in terms of the locations here? Good. One is waterproofing outside with keratin. Inside your bodies, you don't need the waterproofing of keratin, so there's our moist mucous membranes on the inside. So in this picture here, you've got another stratified squamous. Can you identify the basement membrane?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty good distinctive change between the stratified squamous and underlying connective tissue. This is non-keratinized. It's not waterproofing. This is found inside your body. So like we talked, what comes in must go out. So either mouth, anal canal for females, vaginal canal, those kinds of places are going to have moist mucous membrane and not the keratin. This one is keratinized. You might notice there's a thin, clear layer on the outside of this picture. As cells die and get sloughed off to the topmost layer of your skin, then those cells have very little moisture and thus become clear in these pictures. So when you even move your hand across your arm, you're going to slough off skin cells from that dead, dried, keratinized topmost layer.
Is there a way that you can tell a difference between keratinized and non-keratinized without it being labeled? Or it has to be labeled for
you guys? You know, we're not going to test you guys on that. I would probably look for the lack of those clear cells in the non-keratinized. Keratinized has the clear cells out there, but we're not going to ask you that. This picture has stratified squamous, and this is all dead, dried, packed skin cells, and even this stuff here is still stratified squamous. The basement membrane is here. It's a groovy bottom layer. And I wanted to make a point about this because if this was your basement membrane, look how flat and smooth that is. Imagine wearing a shoe or a tight piece of clothing that rubbed that layer. It's actually more like 50 layers of cells, but rub that. This would all come off, right? Blister it up. So it's important that we have a grooved layer. What does that do for the epidermis? Connects it, yeah. So it's kind of like an egg crate, you know, that you can put on your bed. It has a lock and groove appearance that keeps the epithelial tissue, or in our case with the skin, the epidermis, locked in with the underlying dermis. You know, if you've ever had a really tight brand new shoe, one that rubs a blister, you know that you've got water collected between those groovy layers of the epithelial tissue and the underlying connective. So it takes a lot of wear and tear to get the two layers to friction apart from one another. Okay, so we've seen that picture. Okay, let's talk about simple cuboidal next. How many cell layers here?
One.
Just one. In this picture, where is the apical surface? On the bottom. Yeah. That is your apical surface. So just got to be on your toes, right? Because sometimes on lab tests, they'll flip them upside down. The apical surface here happens to be ciliated, and you can tell that because of all these little tiny fine hairs sticking off the surface of that cell. The basement membrane here runs back here, and this stuff up above is actually a different tissue type. These are more commonly what we show for simple cuboidal epithelial tissue. These are kidney tubules. And what you're looking down into are numerous tubes like drinking straws. And so each one of these tubes here has an apical surface on the inside, and the basement membrane is around the backside. Look at the shape of the nucleus this time. How would you describe the simple cuboidal nucleus? Round, yeah. That's what I'd look for. Look for a very round-shaped nucleus. This is a really nice picture. These are simple cuboidal cells here. Notice those nice round nuclei. And this stuff in the background is some other kind of connective tissue. All right. So where else can you find simple cuboidal besides kidney tubules? Sweat glands. One more place. Ovary surfaces, good. Okay. And what is this type of tissue built to do?
Secrete.
And absorb. Good. And the reason you can easily do this is because there's only one cell layer. Okay, so thin layers are great for secretion and absorption, even diffusion if needed, but those thick layers are not built for that. Let's see, simple columnar is next. It again has one cell layer. Okay, so we're looking again at a picture of the intestines, and like I mentioned earlier, when they do a slice of tissue, it's not perfect. We kind of have to, you know, overlook the fact that it looks like there's shadows of other cells in the background. There is more or less a single layer of cells in this picture, and I'm looking at the nuclei here that are nice and elongated. Embedded in our simple columnar tissue are specialized cells called goblet cells. What do goblet cells release?
Mucus.
Mucus, good. And in your intestines, why do you need mucus? Move stuff along, yeah. So we often think about mucus in our nasal cavity to trap bacteria. It does help to trap bacteria in our digestive tracts, and it also helps, like you said, to lubricate along the food that's passing through. Could you imagine having a bowel movement with a dry rectum? Yeah. No, that doesn't sound like any fun. There's a reason that mucus membrane is in this inner portion of our digestive tract. Let things be lubricated and slide along. This picture is of simple columnar that happens to be ciliated, and you're still seeing more or less a single nucleus between our apical surface here and our basement membrane running through here. Okay, and again, these are goblet cells. These are embedded here to secrete mucus. In this picture, the lumen, which is an opening, is in the middle of this picture. So if this is your digestive tract, then food passes through the space in between. This is an apical surface down below and its basement membrane. And up above, you've got another apical surface and another basement membrane. Now, would you call this one simple or stratified?
Simple.
There's
only one layer.
Only one layer, yeah. So between your apical surface and your basement membrane, there's one layer. Okay, so they would have to be literally stacked on top of each other to be qualified as stratified. So where might we find simple columnar like these?
Digestive
tract, good. And that's, you know, the general rule of thumb that I keep in mind is if you think about your digestive tract, you've got stratified squamous on each end, right, because there's abrasion there. But along the course of your stomach and your intestines, you're lying with simple columnar. Okay, so what is simple columnar built for? What functions?
Secrete
and absorb, right, because they've got these goblet cells to secrete mucus, and they also are built for absorption. Good. Definitely want to be in the digestive tract, that's right. These are villi, these are finger-like extensions of your small intestine lining, and they're there to help increase absorption. That's our key word, right? So, of course, the small intestine is the organ to absorb nutrients, so these all are lined with simple columnar epithelial tissue.
I hate this one.
Yeah, this one right here plays.
This one messes with your mind, doesn't it? Okay. So let's talk about pseudostratified. Pseudo means false, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, stratified means layers, but in fact there's a single layer of cells here, so they should have just called it simple columnar, but no, they had to come up with a different name, right?
They should call it tricksters.
It should have. That one in transitional, because that's tricky too.
Yeah.
So So in fact, every cell in this picture touches the basement membrane. That means this is actually a simple tissue, not stratified. And of course, that's where the name comes from, right? So what you're looking at looks to be distinctive layers, but in reality, they all touch the cell membrane. Let me show you something for comparison. Let me see, I think I've got one. When you're looking at true stratification in columnar, do you see how you've got distinctive layers and they look like they're pretty clean layers? Like I see a layer of columnar shaped cells here and cuboidal right below. That's what true stratified columnar looks like. When you keep that in mind and you go zooming back here to this picture we were just looking at,
it looks like
it's jumbled. You're exactly right. Yeah. I can't really say distinctively that I've got a clean layer anywhere through here. So when I start realizing, hey, this looks jumbled up, I've got myself pseudostratified, right? Okay. This particular tissue is common to your respiratory tract. So here are some locations you might find it.
Trachea.
Bronchi. Nasal cavity. Good. And notice they're almost always ciliated. And what are those cilia doing in this location? Move the mucus, right. So in your nasal cavity, in your trachea, in your bronchi, we're moving mucus. And that helps to keep the mucus out of your lungs. So, you know, I think about simple columnars in the digestive tract. I think pseudostratified. I think about my respiratory tract. So I use these as kind of a clue word to stimulate my brain to think of the right locations. This one's also found in parts of the male reproductive tract to move along sperm. But you know, if you're remembering respiratory as your trigger word, that's a great way to keep this straight, you know. Let's see, and our last one here is transitional epithelial tissue. It's actually stratified. And back when they were first using microscopes and discovering tissues, they thought that this was a transition between two different types. It's not transitioning, it's just stretching, okay? So the name stuck, unfortunately, but there's no changes happening here except the fact that it stretches. What system has a lot of transitional tissue?
Digestive.
Urinary, yeah. Bladder, ureters,
and kidneys.
Yeah, urethra, good. So there's several U locations here, urinary system locations, that do contain this stretchy type of tissue. Let me point out how you identify this one. It looks at first glance like stratified squamous, but it's not. Take a look at the shape of the cells at the apical surface. What are they doing? How are they oriented? And they're tear-shaped, right? They're side by side, they're tear-shaped, and they all point towards your basement membrane, right? Compare that here. You've got these odd-shaped cells. They do not have flattened nuclei. They are not squamous in appearance, and they seem to all be pointing toward their basement membrane. That's what I look for when I find transitional. Here's another one. See how the cells almost look columnar? They're tear-shaped. They point to your basement membrane, and by comparison, they're stratified squamous. Those flattened cells don't point to their basement membrane like these transitional cells do. Okay. I hope that gives you some help for next week's, is it Monday and Wednesday y'all are testing?
Yes.
Okay. So I hope that helps. You know, we'll be doing connective tissues next Wednesday, but I know that won't help if you've got the lab test Monday. For anybody who does want to take their lecture test early so you can avoid taking it on your lab exam day, let me know. I can get you a test set up in the assessment center for Thursday or Friday. You can check that off and then focus entirely on your lab test for next week. Okay? So I'd like to open the floor at this point to any questions. Anything old you'd like to go back and review?
Yes.
Okay.
This is just also, I have a few questions, but we'll start with
this one. Okay.
Now let's go on off to it. This is off of one of your old tests. And the question is, how can we represent N and then have three lines and another N?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's
okay. So my question is, why wouldn't it be N with a little three? And how is it a triple covalent bond with only two nitrogens? I don't understand.
That's a good question. That is a commonly missed question. I'm glad you brought that one up.
Because then, if there's only two lines, wouldn't it be N2? Like underneath it?
Well, that's a nitrogen, and that's your second nitrogen. So we'll just put it N2 there. That's a triple bond.
Because of three lines.
Right.
If there's two.
So then if there's N2?
N2, yeah.
Because why again? Because there's two nitrogens?
There's two nitrogens.
So the lines in the middle really don't make a difference as far as what the question that you're asking.
Right. You know, I could have said for that question, what kind of bond holds those
together?
That would have been triple.
That would have been triple, yeah.
That's what I get thrown off.
We can do another one. We can have, like, this one.
Still be O2. Right?
It'd still be O2.
Okay.
Or if we do it that way,
O3.
It'd be O3. Yeah.
What if it had H? One line in a C, and then it had an equal O, questionable. That was on one of those tests. Put a C where you got the, oh, that's right. Yeah, and it asks what type of
bond
was that? Is that a covalent?
Covalent.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, okay. If it was like that,
yeah.
It
would just carry the two.
Carry the two, yeah. I wouldn't do that to you because that's more chemistry than we did. Any other chemistry type questions?
I got lots of them probably, so someone else got some. Go ahead, send them all. All right, so Lisa works in a chemistry lab and needs to neutralize her solution. What pH should she add to the base? Why? And my question is why? I didn't write the answer outside. I wanted to learn it, not just memorize it. I don't even know what the answer is, but the choices are 3, 7, 9, 11, and 13.
Okay, so she's got a base.
Okay.
Is that what it says? She's got a base?
What pH should she add to a base?
Okay, so a base is above 7, mm-hmm. and if she's neutralizing, she's going to do one of these reactions. She should add an acid.
Okay.
Acid replaces neutralizing.
There you
right,
go.
But there's a 3 and there's a 9.
The 3 is your acid. That's what you use to neutralize a base.
Oh, you're right. I don't know why I'm thinking that. You're right. I mean, the 7's neutral.
7's neutral, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Keep going. All right, so another question on here says, what is an example of an exergonic reaction?
Okay.
Now, it says, I'm going to tell you what it tells me the answer is. It tells me the answer would be building muscle from amino acids, but wouldn't it be breaking down starch into glucose?
Building is endergonic, yeah, so the breaking down, that needs to be changed. What test version
extra
did you
credit.
Yeah.
No. That is off of exam, or February
12th,
2020.
I think it was exam.
That
was
one or two. It was the exam.
Okay, I need to change that. Okay, ready for your next one.
Justine works in a lab with a chemical with the formula C12H24O12. She works with a protein, carb, lipid, saturated fat, or nucleic acid. How would I know? I don't even know the answer, but how would I know the answer?
Okay.
That's what I'm looking for, I guess. The CH and O?
Yeah, carbs have that basic ratio, which that falls into,
okay.
And so it'd be a carb. Technically, if it asked you, it'd be a disaccharide,
okay.
But we didn't go into that level of detail. Would a one more old test be helpful?
Yeah.
Okay. This afternoon, I'll post you guys another one with answers, and I'll put it in the same place those are found. Okay. All right, who's got the next question? Isotopes. Okay. Let's see. Since the board is not cooperating with being erased. I know you can memorize the definition for an isotope. It's atoms of the same element that have different numbers of neutrons. But this, being able to make sense of it really helps to understand, you know, what isotopes are. So when you see isotopes like these three pictured here, you say, okay, they are atoms of the same element. They have different numbers of neutrons. How do I confirm they are atoms of the same element? Protons, good. And that, of course, is the ticket, because all elements, or all atoms, rather, of the same element will have the same numbers of protons. That tells me the atomic number, okay? And it happens to be that carbon's atomic number is 6. So right off the bat, I can confirm that I'm looking at three examples of isotopes of carbon. I know they're labeled, but you know, you've got to convince yourself you know what you're looking for. The second part of the definition for an isotope is that they have different numbers of neutrons. So when I take a look, this particular isotope has 6, the neighbor has 7, the next one has 8. So that tells me that I'm probably looking at carbon atoms. I'm just looking at isotopes because they do vary by their atomic mass or neutron number. Okay. And so when we refer to an isotope, we typically refer to them by their weight, and that's why we call this one carbon-12. Add together 6 and 6 protons and neutrons. 13, of course, add together, and 14, add together 6 and 8. So I know you can memorize the definition, but you know it is helpful to be able to look and identify what you've got when you've got examples of atoms. Does that help? Okay. All right, what's your next question?
I have another question that I think might be incorrectly marked in our loads. Maybe not, but blood sugar is controlled via negative feedback. Predict the effect on blood sugar when insulin produces. When insulin production increases, blood sugar level will decrease, or blood sugar level will also increase. If more is being produced, hold on now. Saying that it would decrease, but wouldn't it increase?
Insulin decreases blood sugar, so that one sounds like it's marked correctly.
I gotcha.
So the more insulin you've got, the lower your blood sugar goes.
Yeah, because the insulin, the whole point of it is to control your sugar.
Correct, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I guess that's right. These have helped me tremendously, by the way, that you put these on here.
Say that again.
These have helped me out tremendously.
Oh, good.
Like, by teaching myself some of this stuff.
Good.
Or knowing what I don't know and I do know.
I think that's probably the best way to study, especially when you guys are 4 or 5 days out from your test. What else can I help you with? What is having a hard time getting into your head or staying in your head?
I get confused when you what verbiage I'm looking for that will trigger telling me it would be a U instead of
let's put a cheat sheet on the board.
Okay. I usually get it right.
Yes. So when you replicate, you copy, you're just making A's and T's, C's and G's, so no flipping to U's there. That's not replicate, that's... Okay, so when you see transcribe, that is a different clue word. And at this point, we're going to have to remember, use the U's. And instead of using T's, this time we replace and put a U there.
Okay, so transcribe.
Yeah, transcribe is DNA and RNA. Got to use that U. When you see translate, you've got to have a codon chart sitting there. Now you're going to be pulling AUG and CCA and all those from that chart. Okay? Built in, it runs through the translator, and that's what the rRNA is. It's just a site for translation to occur, and so it's just kind of like it's a place for you to lay your mRNA so you can do translation. Otherwise, it's just out there floating in your cytoplasm.
And that's where, so this is where the polypeptide chain starts.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
You got the right. You got the right. Good.
These questions on the online quiz.
Okay.
It has the intracellular concentration of a cell is 0.05%. When moved to a different solution, the cell swells and bursts. The solute concentration of this new solution is, and it was 0.005%. I was trying to figure out how we got that.
Okay, so if you put it in a solution where it burst, it had to be less concentrated than your cell. And so if you say 0.005%, that's probably the only one on the list that was lower or less concentrated than your cell's percentage. If it was higher than 0.05%, it would make your cell shrivel. But because that's less concentrated, water's going to come in, it's going to bloat your cell. Does that make sense?
Yes, because it is smaller.
Yeah. The smaller the number in the solution, the more likely your cell is to bloat compared to your cell. Yeah. Y'all have other questions? No, you're good. All right, have a good weekend, and I'll see you Monday, hopefully.